Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College Online Journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Hello, and welcome to A Better Peace, the War Room podcast. I'm Jacqueline Witt, professor of strategy at the U.S. Army War College and the editor for A Better Peace. Thanks for joining us today. Over the last several years, as the world has remembered and reflected on the First World War, 100 years after it took place, much of the focus has been on Western Europe, where our minds perhaps naturally travel given the ubiquity of images and literature from the trenches of the Western Front. But we know that the Great War truly was a world war, and it involved people from across the globe. And so today's episode is aimed at highlighting the significance of African troops to the war. And I'm pleased to have Dr. Michelle Moyd joining me in the studio today. Michelle is the Ruth N. Halls Associate Professor of History at Indiana University and also the Associate Director at the Center for Research on Race and Ethnicity in Society. She is a historian of East Africa and the author of Violent Intermediaries, African Soldiers, Conquest, and Everyday Colonialism in German East Africa. And she's currently working on a book titled Africa, Africans, and the First World War. So Michelle, thanks for coming to War Room.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So I think when people imagine the First World War, and I sort of introduced this in the introduction, minds maybe gravitate toward Europe, maybe to the Eastern Front or the Mediterranean if we're lucky and have a sort of more globalized perspective, or the Ottoman Empire. But the continent of Africa seems particularly far removed or absent from most of our conversations. So can you give us a very quick sort of primer on Africa and Africans who were involved in the First World War, maybe like the 5W sort of who, what, when, where, why?
Sure. Well, I guess the first thing to say is that the who were Africans who were deployed from all of the empires who were fighting against each other in the war. So there were French, West African troops. There were troops deployed from the Anglophone colonies. There were troops who were fighting for the Germans in their four colonies in Africa. So there were Africans from across the continent involved in all aspects of the war, to include being deployed to the Western Front, which people may know more about because there's been a fair amount of scholarship on, for example, Tirailleurs Senegalais who were deployed to the Western Front, but then also African soldiers who fought within German East Africa in a four-year campaign that technically lasted slightly longer than any other campaign in the entire war. So that's the who. The when really is from 1914 to 1918, and there's also the kind of subsequent demobilizations and the rearrangement of geopolitical arrangements due to the mandate system that came into play. So there's really an entire history of the war that is specific to Africa that is often not known. The what is combat. It's being involved in labor, both within the African continent and again in other places, including the Western Front. So there was a whole battalion of South African laborers who were deployed to work on the Western Front. And where African soldiers fought not only on the continent but on the Western Front, there were some who were in the Dardanelles. There were some in the Middle East. So again, we have to think quite expansively about the ways that Africans were engaged in the war effort in different capacities.
Yeah. So when we think about that, and I think that's a great sort of rundown, is that Africans, they're all over and they're doing all sorts of things. Can you talk a little bit about their relationship to these colonial militaries? Were they fully sort of integrated as full members? Or does that depend on which country and which empire? Does it vary by place and time?
All of the colonial powers had small standing armies that really did the work of maintaining colonial rule. So they were essentially set up as small, almost like quick response forces that could maneuver quickly to suppress rebellion, for example. But they also did a lot of what I call everyday colonialism in my book, which is that they did patrols, they escorted people, they carried messages, they helped collect taxes. So they were, for the most part, when they were not engaged in World War I, really, they were doing the work of maintaining colonialism. Mm-hmm. At the outset of the war, all of those armies were quite small, but they rapidly grew to many times their size in 1914 through a combination of recruitment and conscription. And so the best example of the conscription, the dimensions of conscription are in French West Africa, where there were widespread conscription efforts that really sort of caused significant problems for the peoples of West Africa, who many of whom did not want to send their sons off to fight mm-hmm. in a war for the French. So I guess the short answer to your question is that at the beginning of the war, there's sort of a core of troops who are professional, who have been, many of them have been in service for quite a long time. They're invested in the colonial army because it's how they see their futures. Their futures are invested in serving. As the war goes on, you see many more men drawn into these armies, but not always voluntarily, mm-hmm. And so their investment is somewhat more complex.
And their identity would maybe be different from this core of a colonial army.
Yeah.
When you think about that question of identity, and again, I imagine there's a range of experiences and interpretations. Are there trends in how African soldiers and African troops sort of imagined their relationship to their colonial the imperial states that were conscripting or recruiting mm-hmm. them into service?
Yeah, I mean, I can speak most directly to that based on the case that I know best, which is Germany, East Africa, and the troops who served in the Schutztruppe, so the German colonial army, were largely men who had been brought into the organization through targeted recruitment of men who had some kind of attributes that the Germans thought would be valuable. So there's a contingent that's drawn from that's recruited from Northeast Africa, so-called Sudanese troops, who were men who had been recruited in the late 19th century to fight in the British Army, had a lot of experience, but then were let go. There's a long history there, which you can ask me about later.
Another day.
But they had a lot of experience. They were very senior, and so the Germans viewed them as kind of the at the apex of the hierarchy of men that they thought would be good soldiers. Then there were others who were recruited from within the territory of German East Africa, and those men tended to be more of the rank and file troops who had specific kinds of knowledge related to that territory. And so there's a way in which German recruitment efforts were quite focused on bringing men in who met their standards and kind of fulfilled a model of the ideal soldier. From the perspective of the African troops, however, what I found in my research is that for the most part, these were men who were interested in continuing to do the kinds of professional skills that are pertinent to military service, right? Like being able to operate a weapon and being able to go on long marches and things like that. There are certain elements of masculinity and the desire for upward mobility that could be best fulfilled by participating in the military that would not otherwise be available outside.
Does it grant status?
Yes.
Is that what it does?
Status and a certain amount of wealth, relatively,
okay.
Right? Because these men were salaried colonial employees. They also, when they went to war against colonized peoples, they benefited from seizing spoils of war, including women and children, who often were incorporated into households, into the soldiers' households, or into the garrison mm-hmm. life. So it's kind of the way that I've explained it in my work is that these are men who are in search of respectability and in search of opportunities to secure a relative position of status and wealth vis-a-vis the vast population of colonized
right.
people.
Well, I think this, and that's a relatively common story about mm-hmm. military service, is that it's a way in to a formal sort of administrative state system that
yes.
that grants rights and privileges and status
mm-hmm.
and in different ways. For the men who travel outside of the continent, who go to the Western Front or to other fronts in the Great War, is their experience different from those who stay on the African continent?
Yeah, that's an interesting way of thinking about it. Yes, I mean, the basic answer is yes, of course, because they are existing in a kind of an environment that is all new, right? I mean, they're experiencing life amongst a mainly European population. They're experiencing a completely different kind of warfare by order of magnitude,
mm-hmm.
right? If they're stationed on the Western Front, they're seeing something that is, I mean, there's nothing that is like it
comparable
anywhere else,
on the-
right? And there's the interesting experience too of kind of the disorientation of being transported from one geography to another, and sort of experiencing this complete upheaval in how one perceives the world.
Mm-hmm.
So there are really interesting oral histories of tirailleurs Senegalais who were transported from West Africa to France, who remembered the experience of being on ships and sort of not being floored by the expanse of the ocean
yeah.
and sort of the disorientation of that kind of thing. So yeah, I mean, I think there is there are certainly elements of that experience that need to be accounted for. On the other hand, combat in many ways is combat. And so soldiers in German East Africa never left that place, and it was an expansive space. But they also experienced tremendous hardships.
They can still be far away from home.
Yep.
You can still experience intense, you know, psychological
disease,
pressures, disease.
Deprivation, exhaustion, all of those things.
Absolutely.
So,
after the war, and you talked a little bit about demobilization and what happens later on, I'd like to maybe continue thinking about that story and what happens to African troops who serve in the First World War in these colonial armies once the First World War officially ends. So we know that there's a sort of wave toward, it's not quite maybe decolonization, but there's an anti-colonial sort of moment, maybe of national movements and things like that
mm-hmm.
in the late 19-teens. What happens to that story, and what happens to those African troops who have served in the colonial army?
Well, what's interesting is that that movement towards anti-colonial thinking really, as far as the African continent is concerned, only is a factor on a mass scale in Egypt. And so there are other places where there's anti-colonial, where there are expressions of anti-colonial resistance, but they're much more confined, and they seem to have really pretty conservative goals, right? And for the
mm-hmm.
most part, soldiers want to be paid, and they want to be cared for, and they want privileges. They want they imagine themselves as people who deserve a place within a colonial economy that's going to allow them to continue to assert this kind of respectability and allow them to perform their roles as householders and that sort of thing. So it's hard to see in the 1920s any sort of mass movement towards what we can see coming after World War II, which is independence, right? But what you do see are men who are beginning to use some of the skills that the colonial state has made available to them through literacy, through a certain level of awareness of being able to participate in these vocabularies and discourses around self-determination and that sort of thing, that kind of begin to inform a still quite, I would say, a conservative version of anti-colonialism, but one which asserts that they are men who deserve to self-determine at some point.
And be full participants.
And so it's not, I mean, it's interesting because it's, if you look at, say, what's happening in the United States for African-American veterans, for example, the language of citizenship and being able to achieve full citizenship through one's military service is a very active kind of discourse. Mm-hmm. But in the colonial settings that I know, at least, that's not really happening. It's not happening in those terms. So this is something I've been thinking about a lot, actually. So why is it that in one space you have these sort of very limited ideas of how one lives through the post-war experience, and in other places you have a much more kind of radical engagement with anti-colonial politics.
Yeah. And it's so deeply ingrained with questions of identity, of self-determination, of political, a political sense of self, citizenship, and the rights therein. I think one of the things that's really interesting to think about is how those conversations are different in different places, and what the different contexts do. So I think that's a really helpful point of comparison, because that we know that the role of African American veterans in the United States in the 20s is really stunning in terms of the cultivation of political consciousness and political identity for them. When you think about 100 years after the First World War, now 100 plus, I guess, what do you think are the long-term sort of implications or ramifications of African troops' service in the First World War? Why is this an important story for us to know?
Well, I think the French case is the one that is in some ways the most instructive, because what you begin to see after World War One is a much more kind of direct correlation for Francophone African troops between the notion of their military service and certain promises that they expect to be fulfilled by the French government. And the fact that they were deployed to France as well kind of opens up a way of seeing the world that allows many of them to imagine a life in France, for example. And so then what you see happening over the course of the 20th century is a real kind of back and forth between the French state and French Francophone African veterans about what service means and the extent to which their service equates to their ability to realize a set of rights and privileges. And that happens it builds over the course of the 20th century, both after World War I and after World War II, where you have veterans who are very much invested in trying to push the French state to recognize what's owed to them, and they call it a blood debt. And so I think that's one important legacy that we can think about, that, you know, despite the fact that independence happened in the 60s for most African countries, there was still a lot of unfinished business, in as much as, at least just thinking strictly in terms of military service, veterans perceived themselves to be both a part of La Francophonie and potential leaders of these newly independent states, right? And so they're trying to negotiate that status. And so, you know, I think thinking more carefully about how all of those threads work out over the course of the 20th mm-hmm. century and into the 21st is an interesting problem. I also think it's important to account for the ways that the post-war realignment of empires, most notably the seizure of the former German colonies and incorporation of those colonies into British, French, and in the case of what had been German Southwest Africa, South Africa. South Africa becomes a mandate power after World War I. Those geopolitical realignments, I think, have not been looked at as closely as they should be, because I think people have just sort of bought into, okay, so the mandates take over and the lines on the map look like this, and then we just march through the rest of the 20th century.
But this, it fundamentally shapes the political landscape of contemporary Africa.
Absolutely.
Just like World War I, post-World War I agreements shape the modern Middle East.
Yes.
There's all sorts of political realignments. Is mm-hmm. there a difference in terms of interpretation or expectations among African troops who are on sort of the winning or losing sides? Is there a difference between how French or forces that fought with the French mm-hmm. or the British maybe are different from forces who were with the German army?
Yeah, so this is what I'm actually writing about right now, which is that veterans of the Schutztruppe in German East Africa were really kind of left with nothing at the end of the war mm-hmm. because Germany lost and all of the officers...
Yeah, if there's an obligation of the state, then the losing state doesn't maybe have a lot to give.
Right, and in a face-to-face kind of setting like this, where the state are actually the officers that you know and work with, right? I mean, I think when we think of the state, we think of these multiple layers. But, I mean, here we're talking about men who work for officers, mm-hmm. who work for work alongside administrators, and they all are kind of interfacing with each other in a very personal way. When all of those German officers and NCOs go back to Germany, the Askari, the African soldiers, are kind of just left with nothing, mm-hmm. and they don't have any new ties to the new hegemon, the British in East Africa. So it means that for the most part, the ex-German troops are kind of left to make their way through this new environment. And the British are suspicious of them to a certain degree because they fought for the other side. And they, you know, these are not men who have other kind of other marketable skills, let's say, to go and do other things for either for the colonial government or for some other mm-hmm. In some other economy. So many of them end up simply impoverished, and they spend the rest of their lives trying to get the Germans to kind of acknowledge them, and there are in fact connections between German veterans organizations sending, you know, who are interested in trying to support the old African Askari. So they're sending donations, and the consulates are involved in trying to track and trace where these old men are. And so it's so that is, I think, important to think about in terms of the relationship between the states or other entities that employ soldiers and the soldiers themselves, and, you know, what is really contained in that relationship. Mm-hmm. Is it simply about a financial connection, or is there more there? And in the German case, you know, it does seem that there was some sort of bonds of affection between the German officers and their old soldiers.
Sure.
And they tried to send money back to help support them, but of course that's never enough. And what the soldiers really want is for the old German state to take care of them, and that's not really happening because it doesn't. The formal relationship, the political relationship, has been severed.
No longer exist.
Yeah,
so these are all sorts of interesting questions about the relationship between military service and citizenship, obligation, subjectivity, the personal relationships that are formed in war, the experience of combat, the role of veterans. So I've just rattled off like 20 different things. I've learned a lot from our conversation. Thanks so much for coming.
Thanks for having me
today. And I think we've got lots to learn and lots more to look forward to.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed this podcast and want to hear even more great content, subscribe to A Better Peace, the War Room Podcast, at iTunes, Google Play, or your favorite subscription service.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.